What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Clean Libertarian Podcast. And I have a very special episode for y'all today. This is Melvin Batiste. This is a gentleman that I've had the pleasure of working with in my current position. And he's also someone who spent 38 years of his life in prison for a crime that he was not guilty of. And you want to talk about having a cultural shock after spending 38 years in prison, you know. So kind of one of the things that I do, I work a lot with people in the reentry field, you know, people getting out of prison. And a lot of them, it takes them a while to get acclimated to life outside, you know, especially after a long, long time behind the walls. But Melvin, you wouldn't know unless he were to tell you. You know, this is just someone who embodies the better parts of the human element, very calm, cool, and collected. And yeah, he's just a phenomenal human being. And I was so excited to have him on the show to share his story and kind of talk about, you know, what it was like, where he came from, and you know, what he's looking for into the future. And so without any further ado, here is Mel. All right, man, Mel, I have been looking forward to this for a long time, man. I'm glad that we could finally get together to sit down and have this conversation. But how you doing, sir?
Bro, I'm doing really good, Drew. You know, I came here to the team building today for a to oversee a tribal council meeting that's being held here on the first floor conference room. So it's been a blessing to sit and listen to my tribal councils talk about projects and developments that they got going on.
That's big league status stuff right there, man, that you're making moves over there. And I definitely want to hear about kind of that part of it. But Mel and I work together, and Mel, you have blessed me by being able to hear some of your story and knowing where you came from. And I wanted to share that with my audience. So I'm primarily going to put the ball in your court and just kind of let you tell your story, as much of it as you would like to tell. So let my audience know who you are.
All right. My name is Melvin Batiste, and I'm 61 years old. I am a Native American. I'm tribal affiliated with the Muscogee Creek and Choctaw Nations of Oklahoma. I'm also was born and raised for the first 10 years of my life in Los Angeles, California. And in 1970, my grandmother passed away, and so our family moved back to Oklahoma, where my mother, who is a full-blood Creek, fluent in her language, lived in Wetumpka, Oklahoma. And so we all moved back here to Oklahoma. My dad, who is a full-blood Choctaw and very fluent in his language, moved back with us. And he had to come live within the Creek Nation people because, according to the traditions of the tribe, our tribes are maternal tribes. And so everything is handed down through the mother's side. And so when my father married my mother, and when it was time to raise the family, they had to do it in the Creek way, the Muscogee Creek way. And so when we moved back to Oklahoma, we had to go live within the Creek reservation. Which, of course, my dad wasn't too happy about that, but, you know, he loved my mom, so he came and moved. And for the next, eight years, we lived in the Creek Nation. It's funny that being a full blood but mixed tribes, being raised in California, I didn't know I was Native. I didn't know I was Native for the first 8 years of my life. And the funny story about it is how I found out was when we were traveling back to Oklahoma to visit my grandparents. We were going through Arizona and New Mexico, and you have those road signs that talks about, you know, this next stop, come and see some Native American artifacts and come and buy some Native American traditional items. And I remember one time it said, and stop and meet some Indians. And so I told my dad, I said, hey, Dad, stop. I want to meet some Indians. And he looked at me and he just kind of smiled. And he said, look around this car, boy, if you want to meet some Indians. And I was like, what? And he's like, you are Indian.
Yeah.
And I was like, all that time I thought of his, I was Hispanic, because that was all my friends. I was raised in a Hispanic neighborhood. And so that's my discovery of being Native. And but when we finally moved to back from California to Oklahoma, I really got into my traditions, my culture. And a lot of my family in Oklahoma were very traditional, very cultured people. And so I learned firsthand from them of what it meant to, you know, live as a Native in Oklahoma. And so at that time, you know, I went to a little school called Wetumpka. It's in eastern Oklahoma. And off and on, I would be sent to Indian boarding schools. And then my mom would miss us. And so she'd come get me and my brothers and sisters back. And a couple of years later, they'd send us off again and they'd come and get us. But in 1979, I graduated from Wetumpka High School and went on to Tulsa. And being from the city, you know, I wanted that city life again. And so I moved to Tulsa, which wasn't a great city. It was like a big town. But I went and I went to American Welding School, got my certificate in welding, and began to start a career as a welder with a company called Flint Steel. But the problem was when I was younger, my father was an alcoholic. My mother was a staunch believer in Jesus Christ. And my dad influenced a lot of us kids, actually all of us kids, and we all began to drink alcohol. And I guess I was the worst. I took it to the streams. Everybody drank alcohol, but I had to have the alcohol. I had to have the marijuana. I had to have the LSD. And then I eventually went into, you know, hard drugs like meth and heroin and stuff like that. And so during my high school years, I had met a young girl named Tammy Fade, and me and her had a young blooming relationship from the time I was 15, she was 13, until I got a year out of high school and she was a junior. And she came up and lived with me in Tulsa. And she lived just for about 4 or 5 months, and I sent her to her dad so that I can finish welding school, and then I would come. I promised her to, as soon as I finished, I'd come pick her up, we'd marry, and we'd have our happy ever after. But after I sent her off, the drugs and alcohol got the best of me, and I never went and got her. And so for 35 years, time went by to where, after she had left, I got myself in trouble. And next thing I know, in 1984, I found myself in the county jail facing the most serious charge that a man can face in the criminal justice system. I was accused of taking the life of a man, which I know I did not do, and which shows I did not do. But I found myself facing that charge, murder one. I took it to trial. The jury convicted me of that crime. Even though the state of Oklahoma sought to take my life with the death penalty, my jury handed me a life with parole, which again was better than the death sentence, but it was also still living the rest of my life in prison. And so at that point, I went to prison as an angry young man, knowing that I shouldn't be in here for a crime that I didn't commit. And so for the first 12 years of my incarceration, I acted out. You know, I became what the prison wanted me to become and not be who I was. And so I sold drugs in prison. I fought a lot in prison, and I just did things that was unfamiliar for me. So after about 12 years, I just got really tired of the mundane operation of life, of getting in trouble, get sent to the maximum security prison and lock up and solitary confinement, and then getting let back out and getting in trouble again and going back and forth. Until in 1995, I just said, you know, I'm done with this. And so at that time, I felt like I needed to make a change. And one of the first things I needed to make was I needed to find a spiritual path. And so I had been practicing my Native religious ways, but I knew that my mother had raised me in the church. And so in 1995, I called out to Jesus Christ, and he answered me, and I became a staunch believer in Jesus. And for the next 26 years, I took the gospel of Jesus Christ and ministered to my fellow inmates in prison, to the point to where even I was given a prison ministry called Native Americans in Christ, Wings Like an Eagle Ministry, in which was a ministry that used my culture, my native culture, to express my faith in Christ. And it was a ministry that so blessed my heart to see not only just natives come to Christ through that ministry, but many other people who came to see and experience a church service that they never seen before. A church service that had a native drum, that had native instruments being used, that were the native language. And so it was really something that was a good first impression with them. And so after all those years, I did 38 years in the Oklahoma Department of Corrections. And then in 2020, I went up for parole for the eighth time. And the parole board keeps on denying me parole, even though I had one of the best records you could present for the parole board. I had the victim's family asking for my release, at least the daughter of the victim's family. I had tribal leaders asking for my release. So many former DOC employees asking for my release, but the parole board just could not find it in their heart to grant me parole. And I remember in 2020, the last time I went up, I asked the parole board, I said, what must I do to get out? And their answer to me was, there's no thing you can do. There's nothing you can do. No good behavior, no outstanding conduct that you can do that can override the seriousness of your crime. So in other words, they were telling me, there's no rehabilitation. You're not ever going to get out. And that's all there's to it. Mm. Now, I could have used that, Drew, as a thing to say, you know what? Okay, well, then what's the use of me doing good if you're not going to let me out?
Right.
But then I come to realize that this isn't about satisfying them, me doing the right thing. The right thing was for me, because it turned my life around. To be able to do what I was doing in prison was positive, was life-changing for me. And so I wasn't doing it to get released. And so after they told me that I would probably never get out, in 2021, the United States Supreme Court came out with a ruling that said that any Native American that commits a crime on Indian land, the state of Oklahoma had no jurisdiction to prosecute them. And so therefore, if that was your case, then you are being held illegally in the prison system. And that was my case. I was accused of killing a man in the Indian reservation, and me being Native. So I filed my court papers, and the courts agreed. They dropped the charges on me after 37 years. And of course, the feds picked it up. They charged me with the most serious crime, said I was looking for life without parole in the federal system if they convicted me. But I knew that I was not guilty of the crime, and I was going to go ahead and go through it. But there's one thing that I realize that a lot of people don't understand and may not ever understand what I'm about to say. But even though I know for a fact that I did not commit this crime, you know, there's more than me that was involved in this situation. And what I mean by that is my family, my friends, my community, my tribe, even the state, everybody. There was a ripple effect that happened. And one thing I knew is that my family said to me, you know, when the federals came to me and said, we'll offer you a lesser degree of the crime. If you take it, we'll let you out. I wasn't going to tell you because I wasn't guilty, but my family had said they were tired of doing time too. Because for 38 years, they did time with me. They wrote me letters. They came and visited me. They supported me in every possible way, and they were tired of doing time. And you know what else? The victim's daughter told me she was tired of doing time because she was impacted by this. She knew that it was time for me to be released. And then she was getting frustrated because she thought she had a voice within the system. But every time she came to ask for my release and I was denied, she started realizing she didn't have a voice.
Yeah.
And so when that offer was given to me and I said, no, I won't take it, after talking to my family, my children, my fiance, and everybody said, we know you didn't do this, Mel, but this is your only way out. They're not ever going to let you out. They're giving you this chance. Take it. Well, that was a hard card dealt me. And I just went and prayed and prayed and prayed and said, Lord, what do you want me to do? And the only answer I got was, there's no greater gift that a man can give but to lay down his life for his friends. So even though I wasn't guilty, he said, lay down, take this, and get out. And so, going against my principles, my values of standing strong on this, I realized it just wasn't about me, just about me. So I took the deal. I was let out. I did 38 years. I pled guilty to 30 years. The feds put me on 5-year supervised release, which I don't know how they could do that because I did 38 years and pled guilty to 30 years. But regardless, I got out of prison, Drew. One of the first things that I was told when I got out was by a brother who had did 24 years in prison. And he got out and he told me, he said, you need to go. First thing you need to do is you need to go to this place called Team. They gave me clothing. They gave me food. And so I took that and that was my start. But I realized that I needed my tribe to help me. And so I called the Muscogee Creek Nation and I told them I just got out after 38 years to assist me. And when I called them, they said, well, we can't help you because you're not on the reservation. You're outside the jurisdictional boundaries because I was in Oklahoma City. And I couldn't understand why they would tell me that, because while I was in prison and the different prisons I was at was outside the jurisdiction of the Creek Nation, and they put my name on their census to get money from the government. And I felt like if they could get my money from my name while I was outside the jurisdiction, then why can't I get that assistance while I'm outside the jurisdiction?
Right.
So I went above his head and I talked to somebody higher up and they said, okay, well, no, we'll give you the assistance. We'll give you a voucher for clothing, a voucher for food, but you still have to come to the reservation to pick it up. And so fortunately, I had a friend who was willing to drive me 100 miles to the reservation to get these vouchers. And after I started to work at Team, which is a whole different story in itself, I realized and started seeing a lot of natives coming to Team who just got out of prison. And they got a lot of help from Team, but I realized that they were missing out on their tribal assistance. And I felt like that was wrong. And so I went to the director of Team and we discussed it and he gave me the lead to collaborate and try to partner up with all the tribes in Oklahoma to make Team a center hub for tribal assistance for those natives in Oklahoma City who can't get back to the reservation to get their assistance. And that's what I'm doing right now with Team. Not only do I work with a reentry program to help anybody who's getting out of prison get started anew with housing and employment or whatever, but I'm also trying to develop this tribal affairs assistance here with Team. And I also was recently certified to be a peer recovery support specialist, which you are, and that is such an awesome job to be able to help people who are struggling not only with substance abuse, but those who need that help with struggling in their mental capacity. And you know, that right there is where my heart is with the reentry and with the PRSS. And then again, I get to work with you, Drew. You know, you, brother, you have brought so much into this organization in the short time you've been with us. And so I just want to applaud you for that.
Well, man, here's the thing. I feel like we got a really good team up there and we all kind of feed off of each other. You know, you're a trailblazer without And that's no exaggeration. If anything, that's way too conservative, you know, on what you actually bring to the table. You're really charting a path and reaching out to a lot of resources to people who live in the area. I mean, as you had put it, you know, there's people that, you know who we deal with typically. You know, these people do not have transportation. There is not a chance they can make it back and forth to the reservation to get the things that they need. It's not in the cards.
Right.
And so doing what you're doing, like, you're giving access to care to a lot of individuals who wouldn't have it otherwise. So, and that's huge. Kind of one of the questions that I wanted to ask you is, so you spent 38 years in, right?
Right.
What to you was the biggest, and I know I've asked you this before, but I wanted to ask you to talk to my audience about it. Like, what was the biggest cultural change that you saw within that 38-year stretch when you got out?
Well, the difference when I got out was the fact that, again, you know, the devastated effect of alcohol and drugs, especially this fentanyl stuff, is really affecting people of all races, but especially with the native population, the young population. And, you know, one of the things that, again, like I said, I'm being native and being wanting to be a full support for my people. I want to try to reach other areas to help, and especially with our youngsters. And so to see the impact that drugs and alcohol is making, which is 10 times more than when I was out, but also the wanting to see that, you know, when I saw the casinos pop up, you know, the casinos was not, Indian casinos was not even in effect when I was out, before I went to prison. So when I got out, that's what I noticed right there, was that every tribe has a casino. And every tribe is making revenue off that casino. And that's the reason why I realized that, you know, through these casinos that these tribes have, why they can't use some of that revenue to funnel money into a place like Oklahoma City to bring assistance to those who need it here, who cannot go back to the reservation. So casinos was really a cultural thing that was never a part of my culture before I went in. And now I come out and I see that the effects, the impact that it has on our native community, for good and for bad. I mean, you know, there's a lot of natives that can't afford to go to the casinos, but it's an addiction. You know, I've been pulled in there myself, you know, and so I've worked my way out slowly but surely, but I'm gonna, you know, I know that that's not a place where somebody like me just getting out of prison needs to be hanging out in, you know. I don't have the funds to do that. So I'm thankful for this job that I have. Got me a part-time job just a few days ago. So got married. And that's the story with my newlywed wife, who's sitting here in the office with me right now. But I said that I sent her away in 1980. So that I can get my welding certificate and then come and get her. I sent her to her dad's in Picayune, Mississippi. And I guess I'm pronouncing that right. I don't know. I'm not from Mississippi. So anyway, but I got caught up in drugs and alcohol and forgot about her and forgot the contact. I lost the contact. And so I go to prison, and after I did probably about 28 years, no, it had to be more than that, 33 years. I found a connection to her. And so I contacted her. And of course, the first contact wasn't that great because, you know, I didn't come and get her. And so her response was, "What do you want with me? You know, I don't want anything to do with you. You made your choice. See you later." But I just had this feeling, and I felt like the Lord had put in my spirit to keep on talking to her. And so I did, and she was, you know, she was not married. She wasn't with anybody. So I just kept talking to her. Long story short, she came to see me one day. She said, I'm going to come and see you. You say you're this and that. I want to come see you. And she came and see me on December the 4th, 1995. And it was like, I mean, not 1995, 2015. I'm all mixed up here. And so when she came in to see me, the moment we saw each other, it was like we didn't. It was like we was when we left each other. I mean, it just, our love just hit each other like that. And so for the next 5 to 6 years, she came to visit me almost every weekend in prison. And so now that I've been out almost 9 months, we finally got married 3 weeks ago. And I'm just so glad that I, a man that can be keep my promise. I'm a promise keeper because I promised her I'd marry her. She waited 42 years, but you know, like they say, Drew, you got to wait for the best. So
that's it, bro.
Or that's vice versa. Maybe I waited for the best.
It is.
I always say I married up. So
yeah, and you did. You did, my friend. You have a wonderful wife, man. It's beautiful looking at the life that you've been able to create. And for somebody who had so much of their life taken from them over something that they didn't do, like how is that resentment for you? Like, do you have a resentment in that? Like, how did you work through that and process it? I know you said early on when you first got into prison, like it was go time and you were fighting back at everything, but like, how did you get a journey out of that into a place of acceptance?
Well, again, the reason why the first 12 years I was so mad and acting out is because I blamed everybody but me. I blamed everybody but me for my situation. I had a co-defendant who was the one who did the killing. He's the one I blamed for not telling the truth to let me go free. And then I blamed the prosecutor for, to me, presenting false witnesses. Then I blamed the witnesses for getting on the stand and lying against me. I blamed the jury for believing them. I blamed the judge for making wrong rulings. And so all this was, it's your fault, it's your fault, it's your fault. But then after 12 years and finally deciding to change my life, I realized that I would have never had to deal with a co-defendant, with false witnesses, with prosecutional misconduct, with juries who would not listen to the truth, and with the judge who made bad rulings, had I not made the choice that night to go out and drink and get high and do drugs and not know what was going on around me. It finally took me to get to a point to where it was all on me. See, these people didn't line up to get in my life to do this stuff to me.
Right.
Had I not chosen to go out and do that night, I would have never had to deal with these people. And I would have never found myself in that situation. So when I finally realized that it was my choice that brought all this to me, then that's when I could finally settle in my soul that that's who I needed to work on. Mm-hmm. Not work on pointing the finger, work on developing who I need to be, who I was created to be. And so one of the things that, again, like I said, my mother was a Christian, and she used to always tell us about Jesus. And I remember she used to come visit me in prison, and she'd come visit me, and I'd say, Mom, thank you for coming. Don't tell me about Jesus. That's the white man's way. I don't want to hear about it. And she would turn around and look at me. My mom was a little fire. She said, if I'm going to spend money to come up here and visit you and get you something to eat and drink out of these machines, I'm going to talk about whatever I want to talk about. And so I'm like,
all right.
I said, okay. And I said, I might not hear anything. She goes, oh, you're going to hear it. And so, but I had remembered that, you know, again, like I said, she passed away in 1991 from cancer. And that year before she passed away, she came to visit me. And I remember when she told me, she said, son, she goes, I've been praying for your salvation. And I hope that one day you will get off this high box of yours about Christianity being the white man's way and knowing that it's a way for all men. and receive Jesus Christ into your heart. I said, yeah, okay, well, keep on praying, Mom. She said, but I also been praying that one day you're going to preach at our home church. Well, last week I preached at my home church.
Man.
So my mother's prayers came through. And again, and like I said, in December of 1995, I gave my life to the Lord and preached for the next 26 years in the prison system. So now I'm out here going to a lot of native churches, sharing my testimony, going to native gospel singing for them and sharing my testimony there, because that's what it was given. It wasn't given for me. It was given to share with others, just like this podcast. You know, I prayed about it and God said, this is to share. Share your story. People will need some people, if it's just one person that hears this today, that it could impact, then that's what the testimony was for.
That's it, man. So one thing that I have all my guests do, this has been everything I was hoping it would be. You have a very impactful story. But one thing I ask all my guests to do is I want you to take a minute or two and I want you to address that person that is in the audience who might have stumbled across this podcast and they're stuck in active addiction. What would you tell them?
Well, you know, again, I have to say to whoever's listening, it's no happenstance or coincidence that you're listening today. You know, I really believe in divine appointments. And so if you're here today on this podcast listening, then you were meant to be here. Now, I pray that whatever I say now is not from me, but being talking to you, that you may receive it as truth. I realize the powerful force of addiction that can play and be very traumatic in a person's life. And I know that it's not something that's easily overcome. But I really believe that if you are struggling with a drug addiction or alcoholism, or even addiction can even go into pornography and simple things like money. You know, an addiction is attached to you, then what you have to understand is that you have to know that addiction isn't the alcohol. It isn't the drugs. It isn't the pornography. Those are the result of the addiction. The addiction is the heart, the darkness of the heart. It starts there. And what you have to do is if you keep trying to overcome your drugs by trying to push that out of your life, or the pornography or the alcohol, you're attacking the result of the addiction. And you're missing the main point of the addiction, and that's what's been planted in your heart. You know, a lot of people have addictions, and I have to say this, a lot of people have addictions because there were things spoken on them as a young kid, with people who had authority to speak in their lives. And I really believe that authority is strong and powerful. When a person has authority over another person, what that person of authority speaks has a power upon the person that they're over. And I know that when I was little, my dad, he was appointed the authority over me by the Creator himself. And I remember my dad telling me one day, he said, son, you're going to probably spend the rest of your life in prison. He might have been joking, but he was an authority that was speaking something in my life at that time. And that's what happened. And, you know, I told my dad my dad passed away in 2013. And it was right before he passed away, I had shared that with him. I said, you remember speaking that to me, Dad? He said, no, but I probably did. And I said, well, then that's what's going on. That's what's going on in my life. And it broke his heart. But at the same time, I said, but I forgive you. I forgive you because you didn't really understand the power of authority. many of us have addictions because we've given ourselves over to an authority that has placed that symptom of addiction in us. And if we don't attack that first, then the results will keep producing itself. So you ask, you say, well, what are you talking about? I mean, what do you mean the drug is not the addiction? No, the drug use is the result of what's called addiction in our spirits. Addictions, everything that's happened in a spiritual sense manifests itself in the physical. I believe that if you're physically sick, that tells you one thing, that spiritually you're sick. And it's just manifesting on the outside. So with me, and this is just me, and I'm not asking anybody to buy into anything that I'm saying, but I'm just speaking a truth with me, that when I started attacking and fighting the addiction in me that produced the results, that's when I started finding the freedom from those results. As a man in prison, I realized that that prison could only hold me from going out beyond the boundaries. But the addictions that led me into it, I got released from. And this is the reason why I don't believe I will ever go back to incarceration, because I dealt with the addiction that produced my alcoholism. I dealt with the addiction that produced my womanizing and my pride and my ego and the different things that just caused me to be who I was, that caused me to go to prison. And then while I was in prison, I discovered this truth. And as I began to face it, you know, head on, then the alcoholism was no longer a factor. The drug addiction was no longer a factor. And whatever else, the money addiction was no longer a factor. That doesn't mean that it can't always come back if I let it. But I'm not going to let it, because if I know the impact, the negative impact, it's going to be like we all understand, it's going to be an everyday stance. But once you stand and you continue to stand, which the word says, then those addictions, those results of the addiction will go away and it won't be a factor anymore. Because remember, I'm not saying the addictions, I'm saying the addiction. There's one thing, it's an addiction that produces all these results. And that's the darkness of the heart. You got to put some light. You got to have some light in that heart. And I believe that the light that I'm talking about is the light of God. Have that light of Him, and that light will take away all that darkness. The darkness is the addiction that produces everything else. So I'm saying this because that's what I experienced. You know, maybe it's not for everybody to look at it that way, but I know that that's what happened to me. I have no problem with drugs and alcohol while I was in prison, and while now that I'm out, after I attacked the darkness and brought the light in. And I want that light to keep on burning. And so I have to keep, like a fire, have to keep on putting fuel in it. And to me, that fuel is just reading the Word of God. Keep fueling my spirit with that light. So many of you, like I said, there's good. You were created by the Creator to do great and mighty things, but not for yourself, but for Him. So if you give Him a chance to come in and deal with that darkness, then those great mighty things are right at the door. He'll open those doors for you. You walk through and you walk right into that blessing. That's what I'm doing, Drew. man, he's opening doors for me right now.
Yep.
And they're just blessing me. But the thing is those doors are doors that when I walk through, I realize I didn't walk through to benefit from it. I walked through to benefit others. Mm. So that's kind of what I have to say about that. I want us to know that the results is not what we need to look at. It's the addiction of darkness inside. That's what the addiction is.
Yeah, that's a good point, man. That often gets overlooked. You know, we look at the drug as being an issue, but the drug can be neither good nor bad. They're a substance. It's an inanimate object. It's what happens. It's an outward expression of an inward problem.
Right. You know? What you do with it is what it's going to do.
Right.
So if you abuse it, then that abuse comes from that darkness inside.
Yeah.
So you got to deal with that darkness so that you don't abuse.
Yeah.
I just got this revelation not long ago when I was reading Psalms 23. And the first verse says, "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want." Now, when I used to read that, I used to always think, hey, that means I'll never be in need of anything. But the revelation I got was, I shall not want is I shall not want drugs. Mm. I shall not want pornography. If he's my shepherd, I shall not want alcohol. I shall not want these things. Why? Because he's the light. That light, that shepherd will not allow me to want these things. So when I saw that, I was like, wow. And it's true.
Yeah.
God being my shepherd, I don't want these things. I'm not saying the application is the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in need of anything. But when I saw that word want, it was like it just kept jumping out at me. I shall not want. What does want mean? What is want? It's something that you want. If you want the drugs, that's what you're going to go after. But if he's your shepherd, you won't want that. So anyway, to me, that's what that light does. That light, when that darkness is taken away, that light will say, I don't want that. I don't want that. I don't want that.
That's big league stuff right there, brother. I appreciate you coming on and taking the time to talk. There's mighty things happening in your life, and at the core of it all, you've participated. You've showed up. You know, it's that phrase, like, you know, many are called, but few answer that call. And you're one of the ones who've answered the call. And I appreciate it because, man, I've learned a lot from you, and I know that's just the beginning. I'm going to continue learning. And so thank you, Mel, for everything you do. And just, you're a miracle, my friend.
Can I say this? On August the 19th, I'm going to start a program at Team called the Red Road of Wellbriety. And it's the Native American system of the 12 steps. And it's going to be held here at Team between 1:30 and 3 on Fridays. And it's open to the public. And I just want to encourage anybody who wants to look at how the native ways deal with addiction and sobriety, then I encourage you guys to come and be a part of this circle and see and experience native culture and tradition as we look towards the outcome of sobriety and recovery. Okay.
Phenomenal, man. Phenomenal. Well, Mel, thanks again, brother. And you always have an open invite anytime you want to come on the show, man. I'd love to have you back on.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And what we say in my language is, Adam Chihicha, this is, I will see you again.
I will see you again, my brother. All right. Thank you. All right, there you go. Like I said, man, one heck of a story. Mel, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us, brother. Awesome job. And, you know, thank you guys for listening. Absolutely not everybody who winds up ensnared in the system belongs there. You know, there's so many people that we know that we see on a daily basis who get their entire lives stripped away from them and thrown in prison for something that they didn't do. And that's just one of those things, man, that I hope that we see an end to someday. But
You know, I hope that you guys have a great week. I've got some really phenomenal shows lined up coming up in the future. So absolutely keep a lookout for that. And song of the day. This is, you know, look, man, most of these songs at this point, this is just stuff that I hear whenever I find a new band that I like and I put, you know, on Spotify, I'll go to the radio and kind of play similar artists. And that's how I've stumbled across this guy. But this is King Strang, and the song is called Don't Call Me Lazy. Kind of getting into more of a folky type of playlist setup. I was going to play some Death Clock, but I walked that back, made that decision, because I know Mel probably wants to have some family and friends listen to it, so I'm not gonna make them listen to some hardcore death metal stuff. But this is a good folk song, and I think that you guys will like it. So, thank you so much. I love y'all, and I will see you next week.
Baby said, I'm cute to myself.